Okay, hi everyone. My name is Jeff Davis with Aster Data, which is a data warehouse company down in the San Francisco Bay Area. Today I'm going to be talking about what I think is a common problem for all kinds of businesses and organizations and a good solution. There are a little bit of technical difficulties, so I've got the slides. I've got a live demo at the end that we're going to try and get working directly from my laptop. But for right now, there were some projector difficulties, so I'm just going to do the slides off of this directly connected system. So I'll jump just right into the problem here. Schedule conflict is a very common problem, very so common that we've got a very common English description of it. And it's just very simple. One person can't be in two places at the same time. Two people can't be using the same exclusive resource at the same time, and it's a business constraint. This isn't something specific to databases, this is something about the real world. And it's just one, you know, part of kind of an interesting class of problems that we'll solve, but this is the most important example because it's so common and because I think current SQL system offerings just don't do a good enough job. But this will hopefully be solved by the end of the presentation. First, just to start talking about this problem, we need kind of some terminology. In specific, we need a noun to really talk about this. So English is a little bit ambiguous about, you know, what a period of time is, a range of time, a span of time, some kind of duration of time that has a definite beginning and definite end. In SQL, for instance, the interval type is, you know, a kind of offset from some other timestamp. A timestamp itself is just an individual point. But here I'm talking about events that take up some definite period of time and have some definite beginning and a definite end. And so I'll be referring to this as a period type. It's, you know, just think of it as a noun for the purposes of these discussions, but of course in databases we work with types. So the period data type, it's available on PG Foundry, and it's got a lot of advantages for just expressing kind of queries and that type of thing with temporal aspects to them where you're really concerned about these actual durations of time. So first of all, now we're going to move to constraints. We're trying to prevent, again, the original problem is a schedule conflict. So being database people, we turn to constraints. I'll just kind of quickly survey the types of constraints available we have in most SQL systems to work with and whether those might solve the problem or not. So the first thing we could jump to is, say, a foreign key. Well, a foreign key isn't quite what we want because a foreign key actually requires the presence of another tuple. If we're using tuples to represent, say, a reservation of time, you're reserving some room between 1 p.m. and 2 p.m., then you don't want to require the presence of another tuple of some other reservation. You want to actually prevent the existence of some other conflicting reservation. So a foreign key just doesn't do what we want to solve this problem. If we turn to a check constraint, that really only looks within a tuple. So if we're using tuples to represent some reservation of time, then looking within that tuple doesn't tell us if there's some other conflicting tuple somewhere else. So you can, you know, kind of try and be a little bit more clever. You can say, okay, well, we'll make a UDF, and that'll go look, some kind of user-defined function that will go out in the table and look for some other conflict. But that's got all kinds of race conditions. That's really not an advisable thing to do. So what we're really looking for is something that actually prevents the existence of some other tuple, because we're trying to prevent conflicts. So unique is almost there. It's really the closest semantically to really what we're trying to do. If you have one tuple with you know, x equals 5 and another tuple with x equals 5, it can actually say, well, if the first one exists, then the second one can't. even if the rest of the tuples are, the rest of the columns in the tuple may be different, it allows you to specify this condition where they conflict, only based on equality. But if one tuple x equals 5, another tuple x equals 5, it can actually prevent those from existing, regardless of any concurrent access or any other problems like that. You can kind of look at it effectively like a predicate lock on a very simple predicate. As you're inserting a tuple with x equals 5, it'll actually lock out and prevent any other tuples from being inserted. They'll all have to wait for it, not all other tuples, just other tuples with x equals 5. And it'll essentially make all of the transactions inserting some tuple with x equals 5 wait on the first transaction. And then tuples where x is not equal 5, those can all go through without being interrupted or delayed. So this is pretty close to what we want, right? We're trying to prevent schedule conflicts. We've got this condition where we're trying to say that, you know, one tuple precludes the existence of a whole lot of other tuples. And so this is close. One thing about unique is that really this is the only kind of constraint that's anywhere close to what we're trying to use, and there's a lot of special code paths throughout Postgres and other database systems, I'm sure, to enforce this type of constraint, which is sort of unique among constraints. For instance, in Postgres, the current unique implementation in 8.4 and previously does not work for the gist index types or hash index types. It only works for B-tree, and there's some other kind of special parts about the way it's implemented. So it's almost good enough, but it's just not quite good enough. We're trying to prevent two tuples from conflicting where the conflict condition is really overlaps, not equals, because surely unique would work if I was trying to reserve a room between 1 p.m. and 2 p.m. and somebody else was trying to reserve a room between 1 p.m. and 2 p.m. You could say, okay, these things overlap, or these things are actually equal, and so they would conflict, and a unique constraint would work in that case. However, if it's, you know, let's say one person tries to reserve between 1 p.m. and 2 p.m., somebody else tries to reserve between 1:30 p.m. and 2:30 p.m., you still have a real conflict in the real world, and somebody is going to be disappointed, but you don't have a way to make unique recognize that those two actually conflict. So really what you're looking for is you're looking for a non-overlapping constraint rather than a kind of constraint saying that these two tuples can't have this field be equal. These two tuples can't have this particular field overlap with the other tuples field. So we've got this very common requirement. Everyone knows what a schedule conflict is. I'm going to claim that the existing solutions out there just aren't very good. Except for exclusion constraints, which will be available in Postgres 9.0. Okay, so let's take a look at this non-overlapping constraint. Basically, what you're trying to do, again, is you're trying to say, okay, one person comes in, you know, makes a reservation between 1 p.m. and 2 p.m. Another person tries to come in and make a reservation between, you know, 1:27 and 3:05 p.m., and you want those two to be recognized as a conflict, and you want that conflict to be prevented in pretty much the same way that unique will prevent a conflict between two, say, equal usernames for some online system. So I'd like to kind of go through and just kind of ask, you know, we all know a lot about databases here, so how would some of you guys approach this problem if you were to try to implement this constraint? There are a few strategies, but do any of you have any ideas how you'd do this in any existing SQL system out there?
Lock the table, do a select, verify whether there's overlap.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's one approach. To just repeat, he said, lock the table, do a select to look for conflicts. And then if there are no conflicts, do an insert and then commit and release the lock. So that's got kind of a fairly obvious problem. Would you like to...
contention becomes an issue.
Right. So as he said, contention becomes an issue. There's all kinds of reasons why you don't want to lock the whole table and database. One is simple performance, but also just availability of the table for other updates and queries and so forth that would just get, you know, stacked potentially very far behind every one of these updates you tried to do. Any other ideas out there about how you might try to solve this problem?
Try it and then have some kind of procedure that comes in afterwards and checks.
Yeah, so...
complicated SQL that checks for overlaps.
Right, so you mean after both the transactions are committed, you go kind of clean up after the fact. Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of an interesting one. I mean, one of the things is you need to sort of have these, it introduces additional complexity into your business then, because now you need to resolve these conflicts. But both these people thought that they had a reservation at some point. So you go back and you say, okay, well, you know, what if you don't get an email in a half an hour, you've got a reservation? You know, I mean, it's then you've got this kind of asynchronous process that may or may not be failing, you know, may or may not have some other problem. The whole time these people actually thought they had a reservation. Then the bumping logic gets kind of interesting, especially when you have kind of contention. Let's say there's a very popular time slot that you're trying to reserve. Well, you know, in that case, you just have this kind of problem where, you know, maybe they have a quick second choice, but they thought they had their first choice until they got an email.
Well,
then,
you know.
Yeah. And if you have
a... How long can you wait, though? I mean, it's part of the issue there.
Well, but everyone checks after they do the insert. So if you see that you inserted and you were later than someone else who inserted, you have to go and delete your own.
Right, do it again.
Yeah.
Sorry,
that's true. That's a good approach. There's a couple problems with it. Depending on your business, these may be big problems or these may be little problems, but one of them may be the server might crash after both transactions have committed, but before either of them before your asynchronous process is checked. The other one is that long-running transactions, right? Something may insert a tuple and continue running for quite some time. Meanwhile, the other guy thinks he has a solid reservation, but maybe the long-running transaction actually inserted, you know, first.
Then transactions.
Right.
Then you use commit time rather than.
Well, you know, okay. So I'm just I'm saying okay. So. There are, depending on the business, I'm just kind of introducing a few potential problems that are a little bit, and I mean, I'm not saying that that these things aren't solutions. These are what people really use out there. That's how they solve it. But at the same time, there is a business specific component to these solutions and a challenge to them. Exactly. So let's we've got another idea.
Yeah, this is one I've actually used, although I can't say that I'm hugely proud of it. If you have something where the range that you're trying to reserve is made up of discrete sized units, like say minutes, you can actually create. You have your main table where you insert a row that says reserve from 11 to 11:30, and then you have a side table where you insert. A record for 11, a record for 11:01, a record for 11:02, a record for 11:03, up to 11:29, and assuming that you're only sort of concerned about things that are discrete rather than like reservations in a microsecond, you can actually then just put a unique index on the side table, and it'll blow up. And I've actually done this, and it works. And the disadvantages are obvious, but
yes. So yeah, there's There are some kind of business-specific aspects to that, one being what time quanta do you care about. you know, which may be different in some security application or a scientific application than, say, you know, booking hotel rooms or something like that. The other aspect is, of course, that you have to kind of err on the side of a small quanta, and that kind of errs on the side of making a lot of tuples for every reservation you try and make. So that is another approach. That is actually one of the more common ones, I think. And I think it's actually one of the easier ones to get right, believe it or not. I think that that's, out of the solutions out there, I think it's one of the more common ones to actually get right. You know, the other thing, you know, kind of to quickly go back to one of the asynchronous kind of checks, you know, another problem you have there that's kind of an interesting one is the cascading. So I kind of alluded to this with the, you know, their second option was available, but they all tried to get the first one because everyone wants the first option. And then by the time they realize that, you know, it's not there, they try and get the second one. And, you know, trying to figure out who to bump around and whether that's going to turn into kind of a cascading of pushing people around, you know, based on whatever time they tried to do something and whatever preferences they had. It's just, you know, a lot of extra thinking that's pretty business specific and pretty management intensive and probably not super well performing. I think you guys have come up with a good range of suggestions out there. Any other thoughts? Kevin?
Well, in a database product that has true serializable training.
Yes, yes, that's true.
You can test for the existence of the conflicting row, and then if there is none, insert the confidence you'll either succeed or roll back.
That is true. So then, you know, the immediate question would be, would the true serializable implementation resort to a full table lock to implement the true serializability, which I think in this case it might be kind of difficult for the database to detect what it can kind of get away with and what it can't. I think it's possible though, to be better than a full table lock, but that's true.
I think your solution's better.
Right. Yeah.
But he can't resist promoting his own hash.
Yeah. 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 No.
Any system.
Right. Yeah. Right, and I think it can do better than a full table lock, but just because of the kind of nature of, you know, the data, we'd be talking about kind of some interesting stuff that I'm not actually sure exists in any general purpose SQL system out there. Could be mistaken, but
it does.
Right.
I mean,
okay.
Systems where that would be a perfectly reasonable solution.
Okay. Yeah. It would probably, if I were to kind of guess at how that's implemented, which I've thought about, my guess would be that there would be some contention in the sense of two values that don't actually conflict would still probably cause some contention if there was some reason that the system might have thought that they could conflict.
The granularity isn't usually as precise as what you have with your solution.
Right. So I'll kind of move on. A few people, as you guys can tell, have already, you know, been kind of involved in and seen how my feature works. But I'll kind of jump through some of these kind of solutions that we came up with here. This is kind of the first one you know, programmers often, you know, think about, which was also the first one suggested. So serialization. We already talked a little bit about those problems. I don't think there's much more to say. Quantization, as Robert mentioned. So this is, you know, this has a few problems out there. One is, like I said, it's business specific. So your time quanta, you have to kind of choose that carefully, would be the best way I could put it. And it's not really going to, you know, work for many businesses, which means your code isn't necessarily reusable in the, you know, to the same degree. You know, it's just for some applications, it's just really impractical. Some kinds of security applications where, you know, people might be checking in and out of, you know, areas, you know, hours apart, and maybe you need resolution down to the second or something like that, then it just gets impractical. Procedural code, I just kind of lumped all this, you know, together. This is, you know, not every, you know, solution out there. I, you know, can't itemize every solution out there that people use, but you could imagine a system using maybe kind of row-level locks that kind of on some, you know, rows that you make purely, you know, to hold these row-level locks that kind of represent small pieces of your, you know, that kind of partition the lock in a way. And you could sort of imagine, you know, kind of other complicated schemes involving procedural code to make this all work. This is very business specific. It would be very not just business specific, but problem specific. The specific problem you're trying to solve would change quite a bit. If the specific problem you're trying to changes a little bit, this kind of solution might change a lot. It's also very error prone. It's kind of one of those, you know, good luck kind of getting that right in a reasonable amount of time, rather than the nice declarative SQL that we're all used to. And then delayed check. So this is, you know, kind of another one. There are various versions of this. It was suggested to kind of, you know, tell the user they've got a reservation when, you know, and then kind of the small fraction, hopefully, that actually conflict, you have to send them an email. It's also suggested that before you even tell the user they have a reservation, you try to resolve that. There are just kind of a number of problems with these types of solutions. You know, you have kind of this uncertainty after commit. You have problems with crashing, perhaps, while you're still trying to verify your checks, but after the transactions committed to disk, and no real way to then go back and say, hey, this, you know, I should recheck these records later, unless you want to do a really kind of an interesting, gigantic self-join every time you know, bring your system back up to recover, which, you know, may be impractical as well. And then there's also kind of this, you know, cascading problem. It's just a lot of undesirable characteristics going on here. So to kind of go back to the example, if, you know, these, again, I kind of keep emphasizing that this constraint isn't some abstract problem, but really a very normal problem that we encounter every day with exclusive resources and time slots. And it's going to be enforced at some point or another. And really, it's just kind of a spectrum of, you know, whether you figure that out, you know, right when you're trying to make the reservation, which is the cheapest time to detect that. Or I said that, you know, the cheapest time to resolve that is what I should say. Or whether you find out much later, like when the people actually both try to use the exclusive resource, like the room or whatever else, in which case you have a lot of, you know, perhaps customer service reps to pay to handle those kinds of cases and potentially unhappy customers. So this is not as desirable. We really want something in the database management system that should be able to take care of this. So exclusion constraints are a new feature in 9.0. It's definitely not constraint exclusion. That's kind of a naming problem we had. I think that the name for the feature, the new feature, is a appropriate one. But of course, we've got this kind of confusion over a legacy, a configuration option that was used for kind of this inheritance-based partitioning. So just don't get confused between those two. And this offers kind of a more general constraint enforcement mechanism than unique does. It's declarative, it's scalable, the performance is not quite as good as unique, but it's comparable to unique. It's a very, very similar enforcement mechanism, so we'd expect similar performance characteristics. It is slightly slower, but it is comparable. And so I'll kind of jump into an example here. Okay, so here we have declaring an exclusion constraint in a way similar to how you might define a unique constraint or a check constraint in the table definition. I'll go through this piece by piece. First, we have the field names. Now, these can be field names or they could be arbitrary expressions. So you could imagine if you wanted to kind of like buffer a time slot with some kind of a, you know, 10-minute walking around period, then you could say, okay, well, you know, you could apply some expression there that would sort of expand the time, you know, in 5 minutes, you know, one way or the other. And then you've got the operators here. These specify the conflict condition. So by that I mean, if this field or expression is equal among two tuples, and this field, that operator down there, by the way, that means overlaps. That double ampersand means overlaps. So if you have two tuples, and the first tuple's attribute room is equal to the second tuple's attribute room, and the first tuple's attribute during overlaps with the second tuple's attribute during, then you have a conflict. If only one of these is true or something like that, it's not a conflict. For instance, here we have rooms, professors, and some period of time that they've reserved the room. And so you've got this case where if the rooms are different, you don't care if the times overlap because it's not a problem, right? And if the room's the same, but if the period of time does not overlap, then again, you don't have a conflict. But if they both, both the rooms between these two tuples are the same, and the time slot between these two tuples it overlaps, then you have a conflict. This just tells what kind of index we need to use to enforce this. Part of this feature is that your operators need to be searchable in an index. So for instance, for non-overlapping constraint, you need an index that can search on overlaps. That's what it uses to find the conflicts. And the kind of index that can do that is a gist index. First of all, are there any questions at this point?
How come for unique we need this B-tree, and for this we can use gist, even though it's quite similar? How come you said that B-tree has a little infrastructure to support unique checks?
That's correct. So there's a slight difference in the implementation between this feature and the B-tree unique mechanism. The B-tree unique mechanism kind of does a search at the same time as it does the search for the insert. The kind of tree traversal for the insert, I should say, at the same time as it's checking for conflicts, because they're guaranteed to be next to each other in a B-tree because of the total order property of the B-tree. So all the conflicting tuples, you know, if you're 5 and 5 are guaranteed to be next to each other in a B-tree. So in one shot, it can go down the tree and both try to do the insert and check for conflicts. In this feature, what happens is it needs to do the insert, then go back and do kind of in a separate read that can see even uncommitted transactions. It'll do another tree traversal to find all the conflicts that might, you know, that there might be, which might be some other place in the index, because we're kind of talking about these spatial indexes that don't have these total orders. So that's kind of the small difference there. And by doing one to insert and another to search, the special case code in the B-tree is no longer required. It can be done outside of the B-tree mechanism. There's a small performance cost, but hopefully that isn't too bad, because you would expect most of those pages to be cached, you know, if they do happen to be next to each other anyway. So that's why, like for instance, using this feature on a B-tree would not actually be too different from using unique performance-wise. It's a little bit slower, but because it's mostly cached anyway, I suspect because it's mostly cached, that the performance is very similar, and tests have shown the performance, you know, a couple tens of percents, you know, difference on kind of a micro benchmark. That's how I kind of escaped the special case code in the B-tree. So the kind of point here, I guess, is, you know, that was much easier than the other things that we were discussing. The other things we were discussing had carried with them a lot of baggage, you know, related to the particular problems in your business, you know, a lot of implementation difficulty, that kind of thing, and a lot of kind of error-prone code, perhaps. So this is kind of much easier approach. It's scalable, flexible, declarative. It's robust against concurrent access, and, you know, really just kind of a much easier approach that you can feel comfortable using, because the performance is not going to be wildly slow or problematic, like, for instance, serialization, or, you know, making, you know, n tuples per reservation, where n is the size of your reservation, that kind of thing. The operator detects conflicts. I'm just kind of getting into the semantics of the feature right now to kind of to nail those down a little bit more concretely. The operator is used to search for conflicts, and it would return true if those two fields are in conflict. Now, all of the fields in the constraint need to be in conflict for the whole tuples to be in conflict. So it returns true in the case that two tuples conflict. For instance, equality, if you were to just declare a very simple exclusion constraint with only one field and equality, then you'd essentially have a unique constraint. In fact, it would be semantically identical to a unique constraint and very similar in other ways. So you can sort of look at unique as just using the equals operator for your conflict detection operator. So here, the overlaps operator would be used to enforce the constraint that no two tuples contain overlapping values. Back to unique. If you specify all of the operators as unique, all of the operators as equals, I assume here, of course, that equals means, you know, normal definition of equality. The semantics would be identical to a unique constraint, and you could use it in the same way. Now, one of the interesting things here is that means now you can use an exclusion constraint to make a hash index enforce a unique constraint. So you can do a hash index with an exclusion constraint using the equality operator, and now you have a unique hash index. If you used it for B-tree, which you can do, you can use this feature on B-tree. It doesn't probably make a lot of sense, because the only operator that you can really use with a B-tree search that's commutative is equality. So if you were going to do that, you'd probably be better off with just a regular unique index. But it does work on B-tree, and that's how I can kind of measure apples to apples the performance characteristics. One of the kind of fundamental
ordering tends to fall down, equality.
Yeah, the total order property is kind of the fundamental reason why this problem is so difficult to solve other ways, is because if I thought about a lot of ways to try and kind of shoehorn the B tree to, you know, into some mechanism to enforce a constraint like this, even for some, you know, kind of subsets of the problem or something. But it's without the total order, you're just kind of stuck, because you have no way to order it so that conflicts will necessarily be next to each other. And without that, we have to use a separate mechanism.
This would still be useful on B-trees if you use the functions within the definition of the excludes, no?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
You were saying earlier that it wouldn't be very useful for the B-tree other than for comparison purposes, but given that you can use functions inside your exclusion constraint definition, this gives additional functionality you don't have.
That's an interesting point, although I think you can do that in the create index. Way. So like if you create a unique index, I believe you can already do functional unique indexes that way. But yeah, if you only had the SQL spec, you know, unique constraint declaration, then that would be potentially an advantage because that doesn't offer a place for an expression index. But yeah, that's an interesting point. So if it were a different database system, not quite as flexible as Postgres, then that would be a benefit. Okay. Now this is kind of a funny application here. So if you just think about it for a minute, imagine specifying, now not equals as an operator satisfies the necessary criteria. It's got to be commutative because if A conflicts with B, then B better conflict with A, or that's going to cause problems. And also you could imagine, you know, adding this to say a B-tree gist. The B-tree gist module to be able to search on not. Search on not equals. Now, the kind of interesting thing here is, you know, let's say you've got a zoo or something, right? So you have, well, let me start with a simple example here. You've got, you know, one table with some integer column. If you just gave an exclusion constraint with, you know, not equals there, then if it's empty, you could put a 5 in it. But then after that, every tuple you insert better be a 5. And so that's kind of the semantics we're working with, which sounds kind of useless at first. But imagine you're running a zoo. If you have, you know, a cage, right, and let's say you've already put a zebra in there, you can put additional zebras in, but you don't want to put a lion in, right? So, I mean, there are some kind of applications of that class of problems where this might actually be a useful operation. And what that would essentially mean is that for any cage, you can have whatever animal in there you want, but they've got to all be the same. For multi-column constraints, this is just kind of back to the semantics of the feature. You know, most practical applications are going to be multi-column constraints, so my examples have already kind of worked through this. But just to kind of lay it out a little bit more formally here, if you have a constraint like this, you know, A with equals B with overlaps, then the tuples conflict if both of these things are true. So kind of like with unique, if you think about it, all the columns in your unique constraint must match between two tuples or you don't conflict. So this has similar semantics in that respect.
Does it always have to be an and?
If you want the or behavior, then really you just use two exclusion constraints, which increases the number of tuples that will conflict. And this is kind of, this, an or, like if you had two exclusion constraints, that increases the number of tuples that might conflict. This kind of narrows the cases of tuples that might conflict because it's using and. Now, you could imagine this just really being of the form, you know, a bunch of, Boolean, you know, A and B terms kind of separated by ors, right? So you can really represent any Boolean expression you need to this way by using a combination of multi-column exclusion constraints or multiple multi-column exclusion constraints will give you the, you know, whatever kind of Boolean combination you want to construct to express the conflict condition. So I think... this would be like kind of conjunctive normal form, kind of. So then you could kind of combine them with ORs, I believe. Could be mistaken here. Anyone else? Okay.
Well, I think you're right. I think probably it's going to have to.
Okay.
This could be, I think we talked about this before, and that it's not there today, but could this be extended to be able to use multiple columns? You know, if I've got a column start and a column stop, and I want to say, you know, start, stop, with overlaps, right? I mean, essentially that's what...
Well, you could... certainly do that in the sense that you can combine those two fields and then kind of like to sort of demonstrate, you could say, okay, well, I'm going to have a function that converts these two fields into the period data type.
Right, okay. Yeah.
And then you're basically just, you have these two expressions and you're expressing the constraint over periods, which we can already see, or will see in the demo, if the...
Could that be done in... So the table would actually still have the two separate columns, and then you would actually have a functional...
Yes. Yeah, you can do that.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So, because it'll allow an arbitrary expression over fields.
So exclude element can actually be a function call that then results in a data type of appropriate, like a period data.
Correct. Yes, okay. you can do that. You can take the base types and kind of transform them, and you can cast them and that kind of thing, which could be useful. So yeah, arbitrary expressions. So basically, if this conflict isn't happening, the tuples can both appear in the table. I've got a demo. I'm going to try. Like I said, there were some technical difficulties with the projector directly connecting to a laptop here, so let me just go to these slides really quick before I try to start the demo. So it's got supports for predicates like where, so you can do a partial kind of exclusion constraint. You can do arbitrary expressions. You can see here that I'm, you know, casting something to a circle before preventing, you know, kind of overlapping circles from existing. They're also deferrable. Now, in 8.4 and previously, no unique constraints were deferrable. In 9.0, unique constraints are going to be deferrable, which was a patch by somebody else. I believe that was Dean Rashid. If somebody else can fill, okay. Kind of checking to make sure I'm citing it properly, but I believe that was his patch. And so this new feature also supports deferability. It doesn't work with gin yet. That's just due to a kind of change to the gin access method. It may be supported in the future because it's in principle there's no reason why it wouldn't work. But we just need to kind of change this gin access method again. And so here's the conclusion. Nothing I haven't said already. The constraints are always enforced. You know, just again, this is kind of a real world problem. Sometimes they're enforced by the database management system, which is cheap for if you're running a business. Sometimes by real life, in which case people get mad or you have to refund them. And so this is a clean solution. And so let's just make it easy, scalable, flexible in Postgres 9. Let me try to start this demo so I can show you guys a more concrete example here. Yes.
This may seem a little inane, but many of my colleagues are of the opinion that they got burned by unique constraints in Sybase that were unreliable, and so now they feel that this sort of thing should not be, they shouldn't trust the database for this kind of thing. They should be
I would say, yeah.
Database as a fallback. And they're of the opinion that they are not in the minority in this perspective. To me, it seems a very outlandish
Right.
So I guess I was just trying to see how far out there they are, or is anyone else that thinks
well,
that makes sense?
What I would say is that, I mean, if you just kind of step back and you say that, you know, you're pulling everything out of the database, then your database management system is really existing outside. And so they're just saying they trust their own code more than Sybase's code. You know, doing it correctly in the database management system is important, whether it's your own code or, you know, the system that you're using. So I would just say, you know, that it's got to be done correctly somewhere because it's a constraint you're trying to enforce that's going to, you know, save problems and money. So I would say that you just, you know, do it once, do it right, do it in the right place. You're going to get better performance, better reliability that way. You know, database systems are a lot better now than they were. Yeah, exactly. So, I would consider that to be a pretty foolish thing to do for many, many cases, but particularly if it was about, you know, some incorrect code a long time ago. I think that enforcing this kind of thing in the database system is really kind of the only place, and if you're enforcing it somewhere else, then that's probably your real database management system, and you're just, you know, at that point using Sybase or whatever system this was as kind of a, you know, a hard drive.
I need the tech guy to come get the cable out because he locked the door on me.
Sorry about this, folks. I'll see if I can get this. I see what you mean.
It's kind of annoying.
No one has a spare VGA cable on them, do they?
I don't think.
You just need 9-0.
Yeah, that would solve it. Okay.
Just give them a minute.
You've got.
I've got a 9-0 instance up running.
Right okay. Now. I mean, well, I have too. I just was hoping to kind of project it. So, I mean.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
And you have a cable too? Okay. Yeah.
Okay. We need to get the cable out.
Only this one?
Yep. I've already undone it from the back. I just need to hook it up to the projector.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Is the adapter still on there?
Yes.
You want to hook that up?
Yeah. Okay. Is this what we're expecting, or?
Should be getting something.
That's just the touch panel.
Okay, here I can try. Here we go. Awesome.
Yeah. There we go.
Okay.
So
this is the best we can do, but.
This is why we added the projector.
Okay.
The laptop.
Anyone feel free, of course, to talk to me afterward if they'd like some more in-depth information. Okay. Bottom is getting cut off a little bit there. Yeah. Okay. Here we go. Okay. All right. So hopefully you guys can see that somewhat. So I'm going to create the same table in the example. Room. Professor, and then the during is the period of the is the period of the reservation. So initially, and we're creating an exclusion constraint here at the table creation time. So initially it's empty, so we're going to expect this insert to succeed. Okay. Now, we select, this is actually the same period of time. One of the things I forgot to mention, you'll notice here that it's kind of difficult to read, but these periods of time, it's two timestamps basically, signifying the beginning and the end timestamp. And the beginning opens with, there's the color. the beginning opens with a square bracket indicating inclusive, and it ends with a round parenthesis indicating exclusive. We can see here that we're going to basically select the same exact time. So we see a tuple there. This is essentially checking to see that there's a conflict. Then we see that there's a conflict, but we insert anyway, so we expect an error. Sure enough, we get an error like this. It's kind of verbose, a little bit hard to read, but it contains the information you need to solve it. And that's, of course, the important thing. We will try again. This is the same exact tuple that we're inserting, so a unique constraint could prevent this. But now we're going to try something that only an exclusion constraint can prevent. Okay, here we go. So this one overlaps. Overlaps, but it's not equal to. So this only an exclusion constraint can prevent. Now we try a different period of time that just doesn't overlap at all. It's not equal and doesn't overlap. And so this one should work. And this one here. This one here has an overlapping period of time, but a different professor. So this is kind of illustrating that everything needs to conflict in order for it to cause a problem. And this one should go through fine because this is a different room. So it's not the same room, so there should be no problem. And sure enough, it inserted. Now let's look at the results here. I'm going to expand this. The mouse again. Okay, I'm just going to run a select statement again. Okay, so now we have, for each room, we have only these disjoint periods of time. They're not overlapping at all. But so for room 1, 2, 3A, you can see that 2 to 3 is reserved and 3 to 4 is reserved, and those don't overlap, so that's okay. Again, the ending time is exclusive, so they kind of stitch together naturally with the actual, you know, the zeroth second belonging to the first portion of the period. So, does anyone see any problems with this? Right. So that is. Let me repeat that. So the professor two is actually booked twice. So the problem here is that we didn't ever declare that constraint, right? The rooms are an exclusive resource, but so are the professors. So we need to do something about that, right? So, okay. So the professors are booked twice, so we'll declare an exclusion constraint to prevent that. Well, we can't declare it now because we're still in conflict. So it's going to abort creating this exclusion constraint here, and so we need to fix it. So we'll change that to be Professor 2 there instead. Or, sorry, Professor 2, we changed to Professor 3. And so now we have no conflicts. So we can declare that exclusion constraint once again. We're just doing an alter table here. It's, you know, same syntax as during create table. And it adds the constraint. Any questions? Okay, thank you. What?
That was eventful.
Oh, yeah.
One question, because in your example, in your table, you use the periods data type, yes? Is it you?
Mm-hmm. It's a, I had a link there. It's a data type that I wrote.
Okay.
It's available on PG Foundry as a contrib.
Okay. So.